Happy Easter. My name is Anna, for those of you who haven't met before. Nice little awkward wave there for you. I just want to say a particular well done for those people who've done Lent and you've done it the whole way. Congratulations. We give a round of applause. Like, for those carnivores who gave up meat, like, welcome back to a land of tasty food. For those people who gave up alcohol, I hope the glass of wine you had at lunch didn't go straight to your head and you managed to keep yourself awake during the talk, though I do forgive you if you do fall asleep, and that will be forgiven. But Easter Sunday is meant to be a feast. It's meant to be like the feast after the famine. We're meant to celebrate. It's a day full of hope. It's a day full of celebration, a day full of victory. And it's meant to stand in stark contrast to the week that we've just had. So in Holy Week, we kind of walk through this week of like betrayal, of people colluding, dark forces colluding against Jesus, and then ultimately ending up in Good Friday, in the cross, as we remember the passion of Christ. And the word passion means to suffer, and to suffer in a way that something has to be done, and a response that has to be done, like something you're willing to die for. To suffer something that you're willing to die for. And I know, I'm almost 100%, no one in here has managed to die for something that they believe in for you are standing before me. But I'm sure we've all had those moments when it's like you have to do something. Like there's an emotion in you that stirs up that you have to do something. And one of my earliest memories is when I was like 6 or 7, is when I was at school. And I've got to paint the picture. I had like big blue eyes, blonde hair, and big chubby cheeks, quite similar to these. And I found out that someone was bullying my sister. My sister was 2 years older. And I remember this like anger rising up in me. I had to do something. So I went up to this girl and went, "You're a horrible girl." This, which caused much amusement because I was about as terrifying as a puppy. But it's something like stirred in me. I had to do something. And what we see in Jesus is that he had to do something. That he had to respond. And that's why he went to the cross. And we see what he's reflecting is the heart of the Father who is grieving. That he sees a problem in creation. Like something has to be done. If you go back to Genesis 6, it says that God looked at creation. He saw violence in the heart of men and on the earth. And his heart was grieved. And then you go through the Old Testament prophets, and you've got people like characters like Jeremiah, and like he's not the happiest chap, but what he's conveying is this heart of a father who's grieving over the world. And then it says in John that God so loved the world that he sent his only son, and Jesus so loved the world that he went to the cross. And why was that? Why was God grieving over this world? It's because there were forces at work which was limiting its flourishing, limiting it from reaching its full potential. And those forces are two loaded words, sin and death. And it was affecting human beings. It was affecting all of creation. And he had to do something about it. He had to do something about the destructive force of sin, which was sucking the joy, sucking the life, sucking the creativity out of his creation. He had to do something about death, which was creating despair. He had to do something. And the resurrection is the reassurance that the problem was solved, that sin and death were defeated. And this story that we tell is the greatest story that has ever been told. It is like the most phenomenal story. It's a story where the unloved become lovable. It's a story where the undesirable become desirable. It's a story where the broken get restored. It's a story of redemption. It's a story of renewal. And every story, like any good story, has to have a good ending. Like, I don't know if you've ever read a book and you've gone through it, you've invested the time, you've loved the characters, you've followed the plot the whole way through, and then you get to the end of the book and it's just like, it's just a terrible ending. Like the best ending is when there's like some kind of big reveal. Like you suddenly see the end of it and it makes sense of all the other bits of the story. There were gaps in the story and suddenly like, oh, I see now. I see why that happened and I see why that happened. And the resurrection is like the big reveal. It's like, oh, I see what was going on in Jesus' life. I see what was going on in Jesus' death. Like if the resurrection hadn't happened, then there would have been a lot of question marks. Like why did Jesus go around thinking he had the authority to forgive people's sins? Like why? And why did this man like say that he was the Son of God and then die on a cross and then that's just the end of it? But the resurrection is like, oh, I get it. It's like, oh, he was who he said he was. He does have the authority over sin. He does have the authority over death. It kind of brings coherence to the whole narrative. And Jesus' story is a story of entering into the hostile territories and claiming victory in those places, into the most broken places and claiming victory and hope into the most hopeless places. And he did that in his life and he did that in his death. And I want to show how, I just want to go through just like different the different ways the resurrection like reveals Jesus. And I want to first look at his life. And you could say like that Jesus crossed a massive border when he became human. Like as God chose to wrap himself in human flesh and to inhabit himself amongst us. To say that he, like God in his freedom, chose to define himself as the God with us. That's who he wanted to be. He chose to say, actually, I will be the God that is with humanity. That itself is a huge border to cross. But I just want to read Luke 17. It should come up on the screen. I hope it does because I haven't got it written down here. And it says, now on his way to Jerusalem, Jesus traveled along the border between Samaria and Galilee. And as he was going into a village, 10 men who had leprosy met him. And they stood at a distance and called in a loud voice, Jesus, Master, have pity on us. When he saw them, he said, go show yourselves to the priest. And as they went, they were cleansed. One of them, when he saw he was healed, came back praising God in a loud voice. And he threw himself at Jesus' feet and thanked him. He was a Samaritan. And Jesus asked, were not all 10 cleansed? Where are the other 9? Has no one returned to give praise to God except this foreigner? Then he said, rise and go, your faith has made you well. This is like little line, this geographical bit of information. And it talks about where Jesus is. He's on the border between Samaria and Galilee. And like that kind of can easily pass us by. But the borderlands were the areas where like no one else wanted to go. They were the hostile places. They were the places where if you didn't belong in the city, if you didn't belong in the town or a village, you were pushed out into the borders because for some reason you were unclean. For some reason you didn't belong amongst people and that you would infect people. So you had to go outside so you didn't infect people, which is why these lepers are living in the borderlands. And that's why Jesus finds them there. And it's like Jesus deliberately goes to that place. He deliberately goes out of his way into the badlands to find those people. And he goes there to show that, demonstrate like in the most hopeless place, I can bring hope. And what he doesn't do is just go to these badlands and spend time with the lepers and then just say like, it's really tough for you, I'm really sorry. But what he does is he goes to them and he calls them back. And he restores them and he brings restoration. And we see him do that time and time again. Like with the woman at the well, when he goes to meet her, he doesn't leave her in her isolation. She's at the well because she's messed up so much that no one else wants to hang out with her. So she avoids hanging out with people. So she's on her own. She's isolated. And what Jesus does is he restores her dignity and restores her to community. And then he meets someone like Zacchaeus, a tax collector, who, again, like no hope. Like he's greedy, he's a thief, he steals from people, he cheats people. Like everyone hated him. Like surely Zacchaeus is a person where there's no hope. And what he says is like he restores him and he leads him into a new way of life. With the woman who's caught in adultery, what he doesn't do is he doesn't get down on the ground saying, neither do I condemn you, continue as you are. He says, neither do I condemn you. Let me bring you out of that life of sin. He crosses the borders into the most hopeless places to lead us out. And the blank in the story, if the resurrection didn't happen, is like, who the heck does Jesus think he is telling people that? Like, what authority, by what authority do you have to do and say those things? And that's what the Pharisees were looking at him and saying, like, who do you think you are that you have the authority to forgive sins? And there's three things I think that if Jesus was going to have the authority to forgive sins, like there's three things I think he needed. And the first one is to have authority to forgive sins, you have to be part of the injured party. Like if someone came and like beat me up and punched me, and then Pete came over and told that person like, you know, you're forgiven, I'd probably say to Pete, like, what right do you have to do to like intervene in this situation? Like it's just got nothing to do with you, no offense, Pete. Like, and Jesus seems to enter situations and it's like, it doesn't really involve him. And he says, oh, I forgive you. And he can only say, I forgive you if he's part of the injured party. And the resurrection confirms that Jesus is in fact who he says he is. He is in fact the Son of God. And if sin is a violation against God's law, then it's a violation against Jesus' law. So when he says, I have the authority to forgive sins, it's because they've affected him. Like these sins have violated him. It's caused separation, not just between like people and creation, but it's caused a separation between us and God. And then he says, actually, like, no, I know I'm the injured party, but I forgive you. I choose to forgive you. I choose to bring restoration. He has the authority to forgive sins because he's one of the injured parties. He has the authority to forgive sins because he himself is not a slave to sin. Like you cannot, a slave cannot set another slave free. You have to be a free person in order to set someone free. And if Jesus had died on the cross and not risen again, he would have, like the Pharisees, what they said about him would have been proved right. That he would have been a liar and a deceiver and he was trying to lead people astray. He was saying he was the Son of God, but actually like he was a complete and utter liar. But the resurrection proves that every single word that he said about himself was absolutely true. And Jesus in his life again and again resisted sin, that whatever was thrown at him, like he would resist sin, even to the point where he would wash the feet of his betrayer and he would forgive the sins of his murderers. Like it's utterly phenomenal the way that like they throw whatever they can at him, yet he resists it. He is free from sin. He has the authority over sin because he himself is not a slave to it. He has the authority over sin because he's not... because it doesn't overpower him. Like Good Friday, like seems as if sinful people have crucified someone innocent and they've overpowered him. It looks like the light has been extinguished. It looks like darkness has won. And one of the things about Easter, and over the years, like Christians have celebrated Easter by telling jokes because it's meant to be like the big joke. Like the enemy thought he had won. He thought he had defeated Jesus. But the big joke is that you didn't win. That he defeated you, that you didn't overpower him, that he overpowers sin. Like he is not like bound or restricted by it. He has power over it. So when he says that we are free, we are free. Like Jesus has the credentials to say to us today, you are free. He has the power to say to us, like, I forgive you, and therefore we are forgiven. And I remember when I first became a Christian, I really struggled to totally believe that I was forgiven. I used to find being in church difficult sometimes because I thought that I was going to infect the people around me. They just seemed so pure and that like somehow my dirt was going to rub off on the people around me and that I was going to make them dirty. And I remember the moment when I realized that I'd been totally forgiven. And it was just like an ordinary Sunday, and there'd been a call for prayer, and I always went up for prayer because I was just like, I'm such a mess. And it was just like an ordinary Sunday, and it was like power ripped through my body. And it was like just this feeling of being totally and utterly free, and I could barely walk, and I could barely talk, and all I could say for quite a while was, oh my gosh, he loves me. And in that moment, I just realized that my sin was light work to him. And if you've never experienced that, if you've never experienced total forgiveness, if you've never known that actually the things that you've done in your life, they do not define you, then know that it is available today. That he says to us that this story isn't a story in the past. Actually, he forgives today because he is here by his Spirit. He liberates today because he is here amongst us, still forgiving. And yet, despite having that encounter, like... I still need to be led on out of sin. Like, yes, I knew I'd been forgiven, but I still need to be led further away from it. And there's two things that I struggle with, and it might be, there's two kind of dangers that I have, and it might be, it resonates with some of you, but one of the things that I struggle with as I continue to ask Jesus to lead me is that I forget to let him lead me. That I sometimes try and be my own savior. As I walk on this, like, as I try and follow him into, like, the land of freedom, I start to try and do it myself. I start to think, okay, like, you know, I can do this. And it's so, so subtle. And it can start by this, like, the little things. And it might actually not seem to other people that obvious because, actually, everything seems like it's right. Everything appears fine. But what's happening inside of me is that as I'm trying to be better, as I'm trying to be good, it's like this tension is building up, and this like the weight of responsibility as I try and be my own savior, as I try and make myself good, as I try and make myself perfect, and I try and save other people. It's like, oh, it builds up too much. And the way to freedom is actually simply to say that I'm weak, that I need a savior, and I need you to keep leading me, Jesus. That I'm never going to get to the point where actually I can do this on my own. I can never get to the point where actually I can save myself. I constantly need to be led. I constantly need to remember this story that he is the savior, that this story revolves around him for a reason. So forgetting that he is the one that saved us, but also forgetting what he has saved us from. And about 4 or 5 years ago, one of my church leaders, he had an affair with a younger woman, and he left his family, and it was just totally and utterly devastating for me. And for so many people, it was just like you watch the ripple effects of it. It was just like I felt for my faith, it was like someone had pulled the carpet out from underneath me, like so many of my foundations were being shaken. And rather than viewing that situation saying, gosh, look at the destructive power of sin in a life of a family or a church, it's almost like I gave up on the idea of ever being free from sin. It's almost like, well, like, you know, it's happened to him, like, it's going to happen to me. So, like, what's the point of even fighting against it? What's the point of holiness? And slowly, I just decided to just lower my standards of actually what I considered sin as. I decided to draw my own boundaries of what I decided sin was. And it wasn't a conscious thing. It was just a subtle thing over and over again. And what happened was that I ended up a complete and utter mess from behind the scenes. And no one else would have known. Well, people I did have, thankfully, some people that I was very honest with. Like, they knew. But leading a youth ministry in that place, feeling like it's a total utter mess, as sin is just like wreaking havoc in your life. It was one of the most shameful experiences. And I just totally decided to trivialize sin. It's like it didn't matter anymore. And C.S. Lewis is absolutely right when he says that idols always break the hearts of their worshippers. And as I was just letting sin like rule my life, it was like I was being brokenhearted and I was hurting other people. And I needed to remember again, actually, like, there is hope that he has saved me from this and that I can be restored. We're no match for sin, and we need him to lead us out, and we need him to keep leading us forward. But the resurrection assures us that we can be free from sin, that sin has been defeated by him. So Jesus entered the borderlands in his life, but he also entered the borderland in his death. And we've heard the resurrection account, but I just want to show you Luke 24, and where it says that, why do you seek the living among the dead? Like, he is not here, he is risen. Remember he told you while he was still in Galilee that the Son of Man must be delivered into the hands of sinful men and be crucified. On the third day, he will rise again. Like, the death of Jesus would have been the most confusing moment for the disciples. Like, it was totally and utterly not what they had in their plan. Like, what the heck is going on? Like, this guy that we've trusted in, he's now dead, he's gone. But in many ways, like, the resurrection seems like even more absurd. Because, like, dead men don't rise from the dead. Dead men don't eat fish. Dead men don't walk through walls. Dead men don't, come back again and start breathing all over us, as Pete was reading earlier. It's like this confusing twist. And the thing is, historians won't say that Jesus didn't exist. Like, there is so much evidence for the existence of Jesus. Like, people don't really have a problem that a rabbi named Jesus of Nazareth lived 2,000 years ago, because there's so much overwhelming evidence. Like, existence isn't the issue. Like, it's the resurrection that causes problems for people. And some people could say, oh, but surely the disciples, it could have been some massive conspiracy that they were fabricating. Well, if they were going to fabricate it, then they wouldn't have used women as the first witnesses to the resurrection, because women didn't actually have any right to have a testimony in a court of law. So if you're going to make a conspiracy, don't have a woman as your first witness, because everyone else would have thought you're absolutely mental. And if it's a conspiracy, well, then the 11 disciples who witnessed the resurrection and all the other ones, but the 11 out of the 12, minus Judas, awkward, all of them bar John, like, were martyred for their faith, martyred for saying that Jesus rose again. And they did not recount, even to the point of death. And John was imprisoned to the point of death and he didn't recount. And that cannot be said of all religious figures, that they went to their death because they said, actually, this happened, this Jesus, that he was dead, but he rose again. Like, that is how convinced they were. And some people could say, oh, well, surely it was a hallucination. But I don't know about you, but I've never heard of people having a mass hallucination about the same thing. But still, 23% of Christians, apparent Christians, say they don't believe in the resurrection. Like, that is absurd, because it's the resurrection that tells us that actually Jesus has defeated death. And that is absolutely cornerstone to our faith. And 1 Corinthians 15 says, if Christ has not been raised from the dead, then our preaching is useless, and so is your faith. Like, that Jesus rose from the dead is vital, because it means that he crossed the border from life to death and then proclaims victory in that place. And death can be an absolutely terrifying thing for us. Like, it's an incredibly emotive word. And in a book called by Shane Claiborne, he says a quote by some other guy, I can't remember his name, and it says that we sometimes tiptoe through life to arrive safely at death. Death is one of those things that we fear. But the thing is, it's the inevitability of death, isn't it? That actually, yes, we may tiptoe through life trying to avoid death, but actually we're going to arrive safely at it somehow. And it doesn't matter how much money, how much power, how much fame, or whatever we can do to buffer ourselves from it. Like, the reality is that every single one of us will die. And that can make us feel absolutely terrified, because we feel helpless and fragile. And also, death can make us feel incredibly angry, because it's death that has the power to separate us from the people that we love. And maybe there's some people here that actually, like, you're grieving because you've been separated by people that you love because of this hideous thing called death. Yet the resurrection gives us confidence that we can declare hope even in the borderlands of death. I want to tell you about a friend of mine named India. And I met India at some Christian conference, and I've been doing a session on the Holy Spirit. It was with youth, and we had a practical time at the end, and just waiting on God's presence. And at the end, I kind of said, people, you can go, and there was a few lingering around, but in the end, there was just two girls sat at the back, and I went over to speak to them, and one of them was India. And you know when you meet someone, you think, gosh, there's something special about you. You don't just know about Jesus, you know him. And at the end of that summer, I went to a church, and I turned up as a youth intern, and India was there. And I got to know her, ended up mentoring her, and she was just the most phenomenal person. She was just so full of life, so full of energy, like one of the funniest people I've ever met. And she was just a total magnet. Like, when she'd come into the room, everyone just wanted to be around her. But she was incredibly strong and incredibly resilient. But last year I had to go to her funeral, 6 months after having been at her wedding. And she had passed away and from cancer. And at her funeral, we sang a song called The King of My Heart. And there's this refrain in it which says, you're never going to let me down. You're never going to let me down. It's a sort of refrain or song you probably want to avoid at a funeral, because it's a bit challenging. But it turns out that was her favorite song as she was dying. You're never going to let me down. You're never going to let me down. And when I walked into that church, like, they handed me an order of service, and I just wanted to hit someone. I was so angry that death is separated, that it's just so angry at God. But when I left, it was like that service was so full of hope, Because India was someone who knew hope. India was someone who knew Jesus. And Jesus had gone into the borderlands of between life and death, and he had risen again. And therefore, there was hope, even in the most desperate situation and the most hopeless situation. But that's what Jesus spent his life doing, going to the most hopeless places and declaring hope. And that is what Jesus is still doing, because this isn't a story that lives in statically in the past. It's a story that is unfolding before us. It's a story that's alive amongst us as we let resurrection power bubble up in us, as we allow him to set us free from sin, as we allow him to allow that new life to flood through us. This is a story that liberates. This is a story of hope for the oppressed, for the broken, for the lost, for the hurting, for the grieving, for the addicted, for the rich, for the poor, for the powerful, for the powerless, for the oppressed, for the oppressor. It is good news for every single one of us, because there is one who has gone into the most hostile places and declares victory and calls us out from there. He says that we don't have to live under sin. We don't have to fear death anymore, for he has beaten both of them and he is victorious. And that is good news.